Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson that helps you be better briefed. I'm Andy Phillip, and on this week's episode, I'm joined by colleagues across our titles, The Courier and The Press and Journal, to look at what has been a tough term at Holyrood and beyond. It's the Easter break right now, but the politics has not gone away. In fact, it appears to be trying even harder to make a noise. So to make sense of the past week and the main themes of the term in review, I'm joined by political reporters Justin Bowie and Alistair Clark. We'll also hear from Adele Merson, who spoke to the principal of the North East Scotland College dealing with the sharp end of the budget decisions being passed in Edinburgh. It goes much further than class choices and far into the realm of our economic future in a country which still relies on fossil fuels to pay the bills. More from her interview shortly. First, hello Justin and Alistair. Are you both well?
I am.
Yeah, glad to be back.
Excellent. I think we need to get started in the here and now. It's been years in the making and it's generated an enormous amount of column inches. It's Scotland's new Hate Crime Act, something that we have been talking about in print and everywhere else. In fact, just off mic before we started as well here today, it seems that it has now become, you can't escape the chatter about the Hate Crime Act. Online, it's dominated by groups who feel it impinges on freedom of speech, that it doesn't afford blanket rights on all the groups it should. And among some on the more extreme fringers, it's spilled over into, ironically, quite a lot of hate. Alistair, I think before the noise affects everything, can we start with a basic primer on what the Hate Crime Act actually is, what its intentions are?
Yeah, so the Hate Crime Public Order Act, like you said, was passed in Parliament in March 2021. It finally came into effect on April 1st this year, which is why probably people feel like we've been talking about this for more than long enough. What the legislation actually does has caused a little bit of confusion. In some cases, it's been misrepresented. In some cases, it's been confused with other laws, other police procedures and policies. But in short, it creates a new crime of stirring up hatred relating to age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, transgender identity, or being intersex. Stirring up hatred based on race, nationality or ethnicity has been a crime since 1986. So essentially, the new part of this law is adding those additional protected characteristics. Somewhat controversially, it doesn't include stirring up hatred based on being a woman or somebody's sex identity or gender identity. Again, that's something that's caused a little bit of controversy. And someone will commit an offence if they communicate material or behave in a way that a reasonable person would think is threatening or abusive and has the intention to stir up hatred. And that's quite important because that doesn't mean that somebody is guilty of an offence just because the complainant thinks they are. We see that phrase reasonable person in quite a lot of legislation. For example, dangerous driving, careless driving is about how a reasonable driver would behave. And that'll be the test for any prosecution is whether a reasonable person would think that is how somebody intended to behave.
Okay. Well, if only it was that simple, I suppose. Some high profile people really dislike this bill. But move over J.K. Rowling, because Ali McCoist had something to say just before today's episode. If there was ever an intervention where the comment itself was possibly more the story than the subject of his anger, then this was it. Justin, remind us what happened here, because this was a very early test of how people are viewing the Hate Crime Bill Act. Sorry.
So Ali McCoist was on, I believe it was TalkSport yesterday, and he was being asked about it, and it comes ahead of the Old Firm game this weekend between Rangers and Celtic. Ali McCoist, obviously a Rangers legend, played there for a very long time. And he essentially used words to the effect of, well, me and 40,000 other fans are going to be committing a hate crime at the weekend. I guess football has often been a sort of, we had obviously the offensive behaviour at the Football Act in the past. And football is, if you're going to see anger and fury and sometimes hatred anywhere, it's going to be in Scotland's football stadiums, isn't it? And obviously Old Firm games have often been seen as a sort of prime example of that when it comes to sectarianism and, you know, the political interventions we sometimes see from fans. But it's important to note, as Alistair said, this bill is not going to make it a case where it's a hate crime if you just say, I don't like that opposition player, or that was a rubbish pass, or I hope your team loses because you're rubbish and I don't like you. If you're committing a hate crime, you know, as Ali McCoist perhaps flippantly said, fans were going to be doing, that then other people were wondering, well, what crime do you mean? Are you talking about sectarian chanting? Is that referring to racial abuse, which we have seen at plenty of football games in the past? To be fair to Ali McCoystat, I believe he's slightly walked back on those comments and has at least said he won't be at the game himself. So if other people are committing hate crimes, then I guess he won't be. But it has perhaps shown how this policy, this law, has gotten beyond the political bubble. There's perhaps a tendency when we discuss these policies to forget that the wider public aren't always paying attention. But I think the interest of someone like J.K. Rowling in this, she has obviously been vocally opposed due to some of her beliefs, means that it's a policy that has gone beyond that bubble. I think when the author of Harry Potter and the famous Rangers striker are getting involved in discussion around a political policy, it clearly is going beyond that sort of just, you know, political bubble a bit.
Yeah, it's a kind of awful culture war stuff that's really poisoning things, though. And there's a very strong argument that the entire law was badly drafted. It's not really my opinion there. And lots of experts in law have mentioned the same, and police say that it's going to be very hard to oversee, very unsuited to being properly enforced, perhaps. So police figures have blasted it. It's criticised by legal experts. It's divided groups. A colleague spoke to the author, Val McDermott, the other day, who had concerns about it as well, the potential impact on arts, freedom of expression. So, well, we mentioned her already there, but J.K. Rowling, she's a bit of a lightning rod for anger in the debate over gender recognition, which appears to have kind of morphed seamlessly from that law, which was last year's big stooshy, to this new one on the hate crime. I suppose I'm kind of opening this up to the group here, but why is that? Why is this lightning rod just moved from this one flashpoint to the other?
So it stems back to this uphill battle the SNP have had with social policy. They've struggled to lead on social policy, even amongst their own party. We see debates on social policy spilling out amongst SNP members. So high-profile SNP members like Joanna Cherry disagreeing with the SNP's stance on social issues. And that's what this spills back to, I think, is this struggle with social policy and leading on it. Again, it's there's arguments around how the law is drafted, the impact of it. But a lot of this is an extension of the sort of culture war debates around transgender rights, around the impact that those rights have on women's rights, and a lot of it is an extension of that, and this is sort of just the latest space for that debate to take place in.
Yeah, of course, in Parliament, Hamza Yousaf is the figurehead for the Scottish Government, which passed the legislation, although it was not SNP alone. Important to point that out. Even one Conservative, I think, backed it, but Hamza Yousaf is getting the flack. He's getting, and some fairly horrible comments about it as well, if you look on some of the more cesspity bits of social media. Of course, this was something that we ended up covering quite a bit yesterday, just before we put this podcast together. Some graffiti emerging in Dundee, kind of sharpening minds about the kind of the country at the moment. It just doesn't seem like a settled place at all. I mean, sticking with you, Ali, you were writing about this the other day as well. What about this, the focus on Hamza Yousaf? He's got some problems here to try and explain himself, but people are just angry.
Yeah, so, I mean, any person of colour will tell you that when they talk about racism or they talk about bigotry, it inflames racists, it inflames bigots. And just by talking about it, they sort of invite those people to be racist. And Hamza Yousaf's problem is that he's First Minister as well, and he has to lead the country, he has to speak about these issues, but he isn't speaking about these issues as you or I could speak about them without inviting that bigotry. And some people have, you know, sort of raised the fact that a lot of the debate around this does take place on social media, but it really easily moves into the real world as well. And we've seen that this week on Hamza Yousaf's doorstep at his home in Bruttey Ferry, you know, actual racism, actual bigotry rearing its head in real life. And these debates do have a real impact on people. And it isn't just it isn't just debates on social media. It does have an impact.
Back in Parliament, obviously, we've been through a term which you saw, as we've talked about in previous episodes, Hamza's first year in charge. There's a break now, and while this hate crime noise is pushing a lot of the other talking points out of the way for now, when we get back, there's going to be a real election campaign feeling, I think, in stark contrast to much of the commentary and opposition claims. One end of term poll just a couple of days ago delivered a fairly amazing result for the First Minister in the SNP. A Tory wipeout in Scotland, SNP dropping just a handful of seats at the general election to just over 40. I mean, can that possibly be a true picture, Justin? It feels out of step.
I think it's quite difficult to tell in some respects. I mean, there's clearly been a narrowing of the polls over the past year or so where Labour look like they're going to gain a lot of seats. The Conservatives might hold on to some of their seats due to that independence versus unionist tactical voting effect. But I think one thing that's quite important to remember is that these margins are often very fine. So the SNP have, you know, 40 plus seats at the moment. You know, they absolutely dominate in Westminster in terms of the number of MPs they have. Labour had a bad result in 2019, but it's not like nobody was voting for Labour. It's just the nature of the system we have is that as you start to hit that 40% plus threshold, you're really going to be quite dominant. So there is a case here where you could say if the SNP have a slightly better night than expected, it doesn't need to be a substantially better night than expected. They might hold on to a lot more seats than people think. Now, I think predictions of, say, retaining 40 plus seats, you know, even a Tory wipeout in Scotland, I think that is quite unlikely. This does seem like it's probably a bit of an outlier, but at the same time, I think it does show that you can't really write off the SNP to the degree that people have. I mean, other parties have had difficulties lately. The Tories have obviously voted to extend the oil and gas windfall tax in the North East. That could have an impact on their voter base. Labour have had some tricky issues to deal with in recent months. You know, you think the two-child benefit cap a while back. There's obviously been divisions over the whole Israel-Palestine conflict as well. And when you head into an election campaign, I mean, Hamza Yousaf will obviously be at the front and centre of that, but so will Stephen Flynn, the SNP's Westminster leader. And a lot of people have been talking him up in recent months, been saying that in some ways he's almost closer to a party leader than Hamza Yousaf is. But if Stephen Flynn is playing a big role in that campaign, if he's a good campaign, that could help the SNP as well. So yeah, it's been a difficult first year for the First Minister, but it might not all necessarily be as doom and gloom as we think.
Ali, you focused on Labour a bit recently and their chances at the election. We've talked a lot about the problems that the SNP face here. We'll go on to speak a little bit more about the Conservatives. But in Scotland, Labour haven't filled all their candidacies yet either. How are they looking at the moment when it comes to voter focus on who's best prepared to take over?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things about the sort of voting intention poll is sometimes when you dig a little bit into the back of that. So there was some Ipsos Mori polling last week as well, which showed that people are much more likely to be neutral about Labour than they are about the SNP or the Conservatives. And what that means is that they don't have a strong opinion. And in politics, we all know that it's strong opinions that count, and it's strong opinions that get people out to the ballot box. So when people are asked how they'll vote, if they don't have that strong opinion, you know, it's hard for the poll to measure, you know, the support that they have for parties. But that could be a problem for the Labour Party as well, because they can't just rely on the SNP voters and Conservative voters not turning up to vote. You know, that isn't going to be quite enough for them, as Justin says, to take these seats. They also need to convince voters to come and vote for them. So Labour are going to really want to see those polls in the next couple of weeks, in Scotland in particular, showing that they're doing that. And a big part of that will be convincing people that they have the answers, that they have solutions to the problems in their lives. And that'll be the big challenge for Labour, I think, over the coming weeks and months. As negative as the SNP could see some of the polling, could see some of the predictions about their chances, there's also hope for them in some of these polls as well, especially the, you know, the sort of back end of the polling around opinions on the different parties. Like I said, it isn't, people are much more likely to be neutral than they are if they're an SNP voter or a Conservative voter.
Well, the Conservatives must look at this, though, the poll. I just wish they'd wake up and it was all a dream. We've talked about the SNP a lot and their problems, but they, because they'd run the Scottish government, but the Tories have had a nightmare. Who remembers the conference in Aberdeen a few weeks back where the Scottish Tories were slapped down by Rishi Sunak, who extended the windfall tax on energy giants' profits? They must look at the south of Scotland and the northeast in particular and think, hold on, there's no way that the SNP are beating us there, but a wake-up call. I would be surprised if the scale of the SNP victory was quite on that level. But I am basing that on previous polls, which does make it look like a bit of an outlier, which you mentioned, Justin. One thing to note here is what we touched on earlier. There's still a lot to filter through in people's minds before the vote is held. Do people just fall along constitutional lines? They just fall back to the party that they instinctively trust? Or are any of these things that we're talking about social policy, will they change anyone's minds? Cost of living, the SNP have made it very clear that they want to make that a central point of their entire argument, beyond, of course, the fact that it's supposed to be a pseudo-referendum on independence. But one thing, Justin, you've been looking at this as well, that the housing crisis, that affects everybody, mortgages, rent, everyone, and you'd assume a lot of that anger would be thrown back at the Conservatives. A lot of folk remember Liz Truss, who I see today is touting her new book as well, which is hilarious. Tell us about the rent cap, because you've been looking at that, and I wonder if that kind of just daily bills, cost of living, how is that going to make an impact?
So, yeah, the SNP Green rent freeze had been first put in place in October 2022. There had obviously been measures in place during the COVID pandemic as well, but this rent cap essentially meant that landlords, without, you know, legitimate reasons or, you know, certain exceptions, couldn't increase your rent above more than 3%. And it also greatly restricted evictions as well. That has now come to an end after those 18 months. There are still limits and protections in place so that landlords can't just, you know, double someone's rent. But there are a lot of problems here, because while that policy was in place, it did protect existing tenants, but it didn't stop landlords from putting up rent for new flats. So if you moved out of a flat, or you bought a home, or you moved, you know, away abroad, or just for whatever reason and you were a renter, whoever then replaced you in that flat could get charged £200-300 more. But now it's coming to an end. A lot of landlords, I suppose, want to, you know, make back the money they kind of see themselves as having lost during that period. And we're seeing a lot of stories of people being hit with major rent increases. I know people who are kind of either contesting those increases at the moment or are being told that their rent's going to be increased. I mean, one of the major problems is, we're seeing this across the UK, is the lack of house building. House building often moves at a sluggish pace. You have a lot of maybe older homeowners who have paid off their mortgages and kind of afford to get a second property. So you've also seen an expansion of the private rented sector at the same time. But, you know, the SNP and Greens want to bring in proper long-term rent controls to kind of hold down rents in the long term. But I spoke to an economist based at Dundee University. We spoke to him and wrote an article which came out on Monday there, and he argued that that won't work in the long term. It's a sticking plaster, and if you want to fix this, it's sort of a supply versus demand problem. So if you want to fix this in the long term, you simply need to build more houses. The problem with that is we have a culture in the UK and in Scotland where, think of how many developments are blocked. We don't have a lot of social housing compared to in the past, for example. And then if new houses are built, people sometimes moan, or that's changed the character of my area. That's going to bring my property value down because there's more houses in this area now than there was in the past. So that's difficult as well. But what it means is you do end up with a lot of younger people who almost simply can't afford their rent. Major cities become especially unaffordable for students and young professional people on mortgages. Sometimes see those mortgages going up, as we did during the Liz Truss era. So yeah, it's really something which is hurting a lot of the country right now. I think the problem is that there's no party which seems to have an absolute solution which is going to fix this in the long term. So it's one of those issues, I think, is just going to simmer over and over in the background for quite a while.
Is that not the problem, though, Alistair? I'll give you the last word if you like. We're talking about these things, but no one knows quite who to blame. Everyone just thinks that everything's falling apart, the wheels have come off a little. Has there anyone got the answers there?
Yeah, and I think Justin touched on it, but housing is one of those very few issues which affects everyone. The other issue is probably the NHS, and apart from that, schools and education. But for a very few people, housing and the NHS are hugely important issues. Everyone knows somebody that's been on an NHS waiting list for too long. Everyone knows somebody that can't get a house or is in unstable housing or is in cost of living, is struggling with the cost of living because the rent is too much or their mortgage is too much. Everyone knows someone like that. And people, I think, will accept that there might be no immediate answers. They accept that the government, either government, can't just fix that tomorrow. But what they expect is somebody that seems to have answers and seems to want to find answers. And when parties have been in power for so long, that's one of the things that they really struggle with, because people think they've run out of answers. And that's the problem the SNP and the Conservatives have. And it's also the problem Labour has, because it needs to convince people, like I said, that it has those answers. And that's the big test for all three parties at this election, is to say that, is to convince people that, you know, they can find solutions to those problems.
Yeah. And of course, housing and the NHS are devolved. And so a general election feels like the SNP won't like that, but the Tories will try to make it all about those things, knowing that that's what matters to people. And the SNP will keep pointing out that they don't, you know, it's not controlled from Westminster, and they'll complain there's a lack of money, and that the argument kind of gets lost, but it will just go back to what people just think are the problems around them. And then they'll pick a winner. We're mentioning budget cuts a lot here, and there's a neat crossover, I think, because Adele Merson, as I mentioned earlier, goes into our featured interview here. She spoke with Neil Cowie, the North East Scotland College based in Aberdeen. He's braced for multi-million pound cuts, which will limit classes and programmes designed to arm the next generation of the workforce. In that part of Scotland, it's all about energy, of course, and he thinks cuts now will make it even harder to provide people with the skills to help the so-called just transition to a more renewable future. We pick up the interview here, where Neil explains the real extent of a much overlooked college sector and what cuts there mean for the whole country.
What I find is not a lot of people are aware about what NESCO and the wider college sector actually does. But we're a large college, large geographic footprint. We operate out of four main centres, two in Aberdeen, one at Fraserburgh and one at Peterhead. We employ 850 staff. We have something in the region of about 1,000 apprentices going through us, 500 of our own and 500 who are already employed. And we work with about 1,200 employers. 47 schools, 15 primary, 32 secondary. And we offer something in the region of 6,500 school pupil places on school link programs. And 40% of all school leavers will come to NESCO once they leave school. We also have a very healthy program with the third sector, and that kind of wide doors, deep reach approach that we have as a college is really important to us, because we are a civic institution. We're anchored in the communities in which we serve. So having that broad curricular offer means that we can be many things to many people. The consequence of the kind of funding cuts that we're anticipating means that we will not be able to do all those things that we wish to do for all those people whom we serve. When you start then looking at what it is that we do in terms of the funding and how we then look at our activity, the reality is that we're not going to be able to deliver to as many people as we would want to. And that's a concern for us, because ultimately the demand is there. We are seeing application numbers 25% above what it was this time last year. And actually employer demand is also very high. There's a further anomaly that is of interest to us that kind of goes out with this round of funding cuts. And that is that, you know, post-merger, which we've now been merged for over 10 years, NESCO was made up of two colleges, Aberdeen College and Bamford Buchan College up in Fraserburgh. And interestingly enough, once we were merged together, the Scottish Funding Council and Scottish Government ultimately determined that the funding model that would drive this college forward as a merged college would be one based on Aberdeen College's numbers and actually in terms of volume. There was a rurality premium given to Bamford Buchan College back at the day, so we were in essence subsidised to run courses, more courses, with lower numbers. That model was never adopted post-merger. So consequently, we now find, and we have done year on year for the last 10 years, that, you know, we have been disadvantaged to the tune of something in the region of about 2 to £3.5 million per annum. And that's over and above any cuts that we were going to get as a consequence of this current budget round.
It's interesting there, you spoke about the energy transition, and obviously the college delivers essential training for such a sector as that. Interested as well, there's been, I'm sure you're aware, a very big political debate already ahead of the next election around the workforce in Aberdeen. Like, what do political parties have in their plans for making sure that we don't lose thousands of jobs and that there's still, you know, a new generation of jobs for people to move into? Do you think there's a case for NESCOL to receive additional funding over and above what it does, given its very specific role on making sure that people are perhaps retrained, for example, in renewables?
I would wholeheartedly support that idea. The concerns that we have, you know, again, prior to this funding allocation, one of the things that we know that was evidenced in the draft budget and has now gone is the Flexible Workforce Development Fund. And prior to that announcement, this college was operating with a budget of £1.1 to £1.9 million, which saw us deliver to many regional employers the opportunity to upskill or reskill their workforce. Overnight, that money has now disappeared, and there's no indication about what's going to replace it. So already, the Northeast is on a back foot. You know, we are disadvantaged in terms of the general ambition. I thought it was quite interesting. Recently, I attended a business breakfast that was being run by the Chamber, and those that were speaking at it were keen to point out that Aberdeen is the slowest growing city in the UK. And again, I think that, you know, gone are the days where we had that kind of economic energy that kind of propelled us to be kind of where we needed to be. If we've got the ambitions, and we have, because what is very clear to me is that regional ambition is strong and is very aligned between key partners. If we're going to fulfill those ambitions, we need to be funded appropriately. And consequently, my concerns are that the longer that we don't get the funding that backs the ambitions of Scottish Government, we're not going to be able to deliver what we need to in the Northeast. And I think that, you know, again, in terms of where we were positioning ourselves post the announcements around the Flexible Workforce Development Fund and indeed the potential cuts to the college sector, we put out a stakeholder briefing. And what was quite interesting is that we got a lot of interest in that locally from local politicians, from our partners, from stakeholders, and from industry, who are clearly anxious about the impacts that, you know, a key skills delivery agent like the college, it not being funded appropriately and not being able to meet the demands of employers regionally was going to impact on what they were seeking to do now and in the medium and in the longer term.
So are you effectively saying, you know, you think the energy transition can't happen unless colleges are better funded?
I think the energy transition will happen, but it will happen quicker and it will happen better if colleges are actually supported and resourced appropriately. You know, we're already having conversations about with industry partners about how we can actually plug any gaps that may come as a consequence of this this budget announcement and what allocations we get. But typically, colleges aren't geared to this. They don't necessarily pivot that easily towards being more commercial. We've already had those conversations internally, and we're working on that. So we're doing everything that we can to actually maximise the financial and human resource that we can lever into this to make sure that the energy transition ambitions that we have and those that are around that actually are fulfilled. It will happen. And I'm absolutely convinced it will, but it would happen better and quicker if we were funded.
That was Neil Cowie speaking with Adele Merson. That's it for this episode. We'll be back next week for more. Until then, subscribe to the Press and Journal, the Courier, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed.